Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to acknowledge the members of my research team, including Dr. Aviva Must, who's here today. Thank you, Aviva. And I'd also like to acknowledge the National Institutes for Dental Cranial Facial Research, who sponsored this study. Dental disease has been called a silent epidemic, affecting our most vulnerable citizens. And preventive oral home care is essential to getting it under control. Since 2005, national reports have called attention to the disproportionate impact of oral health on people with disabilities, including developmental disabilities. People with developmental disabilities face special challenges accessing dental services and also performing daily oral home care. Many of these challenges are associated with the chronic medical and behavioral conditions and also physical and sensory impairments that often coexist with developmental disabilities. Although information is limited, individuals with developmental disabilities have been found to have higher prevalences of periodontal disease, untreated dental caries, and missing teeth in the general population. Lack of information about the complex issues affecting the oral health of this group was cited in each of the five national reports referenced above as a major impediment to efforts to improve their oral health. Now, this slide uses a socio-ecological framework to identify multiple influences on the oral health of adults with developmental disabilities. At present, much concern is focused on their lack of access to dental services, and that's because many state Medicaid programs do not support dental care for adults, including adults with disabilities. We chose to focus on the interpersonal influences, specifically the role of caregivers in promoting oral health. Our research was cited in a statewide network of special safety net clinics that are administered by Tufts Dental School and supported by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And that reality actually shows the role of organizations and also federal and state policies in influencing the oral health of adults with developmental disabilities. Our goal was to collect information from caregivers directly about oral health to use in developing preventive intervention strategies. We were interested in their perceptions of the oral health needs and practices of the adults who they were supporting. We were also interested in their perceptions of the residential issues that promote and impede oral home care routines, and also their opinions about various resources to facilitate preventive oral home care. Now, as mentioned, the research was cited at the Tufts Dental Facilities for Persons with Special Needs. These clinics represent a network of six safety net clinics across the state offering comprehensive and specialized services to approximately 7,000 individuals with developmental disabilities. The clinics were established in 1976 as the result of a federal consent decree between the state and parents of children with mental retardation who were living in institutions at that time. The parents brought suit against the state in federal court, charging that the civil rights of their children were violated because of the conditions in the institution, and the TDF clinics were set up as a plan of correction to ensure quality dental services. At present, MassHealth, which is the name for our state Medicaid program, funds at least four preventive dental visits each year for adults with developmental disabilities. This was a cross-sectional study. Caregivers were recruited when they visited a clinic to accompany an adult with developmental disabilities to an appointment. They were eligible to participate if that adult was age 20 or older, if the caregiver had at least 6 months' experience as a caregiver, and they were directly involved with oral home care. We used a computer-assisted personal interviewer CAPI survey to collect our information. So a little bit about the CAPI survey. It was mounted on netbook computers for completion in the approximately 1 hour window when caregivers were in the clinic, either before or after appointments or while they'd be sitting in the operatories to give support to the patients. It had four sections. The first few questions were practice or warm-up questions, and our caregivers who lack computer skills or confidence found these very, very helpful. The first section focused on the characteristic of the person with a developmental disability who had the dental visit that day. The second section looked at various influences within residents on oral health activities. And then the final section asked about the oral health routines of the caregivers, although we are not going to be reporting on those findings today. Okay. Lost a slide. Okay, this is actually a slide that shows the demographics of our respondents. And we had 808 respondents. 683 were paid caregivers and 125 were family caregivers, and they were almost all parents. This slide actually highlights two of the characteristics of the caregivers that are particularly important. On the left-hand side, you see that the family caregivers were much older than the paid caregivers, and the family caregivers are represented in an orange color, while the paid caregivers were represented in a maroon color. On the right-hand side of the slide, which is specific to the paid caregivers, you can see that 75% of them had five or more years of experience caring for adults with developmental disabilities, and 45% of them had at least 5 years caring for the person they had accompanied to the dental appointment. This suggests that they completed their questionnaires with a lot of information about the issue at hand. So now I'm going to report on our findings. First, I'll be describing the caregivers' perspectives on the adults with developmental disabilities they supported, and then describe their perspectives on residential influences on oral health routines. With respect to the oral health status of the adults they supported, you'll see that none of the adults who were cared for by family caregivers were edentulous, compared to 5% of the adults who were cared for by paid caregivers. Now, this is a much younger population, and it's less likely that they would have experienced tooth loss anyway. Adults living with their families were more likely to be described as having teeth in excellent or good condition compared to those living with paid caregivers. About a third of all of the adults were reported to have cavities or decayed teeth, and about a quarter were described as having swollen or bleeding gums, and those are symptoms of gingivitis and periodontitis. Now, the adult's ability to assist with oral health care, their capacity to let caregivers know about problems, and their capacity to cooperate with dental teeth cleaning are important considerations. And you'll see here that about three-quarters of the adults required direct assistance with oral home care. Most, but not all, were able to let caregivers know about dental problems, and about half were described as very cooperative with teeth cleaning. About two-thirds were able to rinse and spit, which facilitates oral care. And about a quarter were at risk for aspiration, which requires very special care and consideration. Most of the adults used over-the-counter toothpaste, and a much smaller proportion used over-the-counter mouthwash. The use of prescription toothpaste and prescription mouthwash was very low, given indications that this would be very valuable for a high-risk population like this. The use of adaptive devices like toothbrushes with large handles or large brushes, and also the use of mouth props was very low, even though these are generally found helpful. Most of the adults were brushing their teeth at least twice a day as recommended by the ADA. However, only about a third were flossing their teeth at least once a day as recommended. And a concern was that there was a high percentage, 45% of those living with paid caregivers and 35% living with family caregivers who flossed their teeth less than once a week. Now I'm going to shift gears and describe what caregivers said about some of the residential influences on oral home care routines. When we asked caregivers what kinds of factors interfered with oral home care routines, you'll see that families were more likely to report lack of time, not having enough help as interferences. Both groups, however, noted that the individual's behavioral issues did interfere with oral home care. This is a little bit more information about the kinds of behavioral issues that can make it difficult for a caregiver to assist with oral home care, and they include such things as not opening their mouth, biting on the toothbrush, individuals who gag, individuals who move their heads and bodies around, or they may be resistant to touch. A high percentage of caregivers reported feeling very confident about their toothbrushing skills, but much less confident about their skills with respect to flossing. Both groups, however, felt very confident to deal with the kinds of behavioral challenges I just described. We're interested in how caregivers learn to assist with oral home care. And what you see on the left is that the paid caregivers had the opportunities for many more formal forms of instruction and support, as opposed to families who seem to lack that kind of formal instruction. And in fact, a very high percentage of families, close to two-thirds, describe that they learn to assist with oral home care by trial and error. Okay. And then last but not least, we actually found some statistically significant differences between the caregivers' ratings of the usefulness of various instructional resources, with families rating each of the particular resources as less useful than the paid caregivers. Okay. So what are our conclusions? That caregivers are finding it difficult to support adults with developmental disabilities with daily oral home care, with many more problems around flossing than with toothbrushing. They did report more confidence in their skills to assist with toothbrushing than with flossing. The supplies to do all of the above were not always available in residences. Despite the prevalence of behavioral issues, caregivers reported, they had reported that they felt very confident to deal with them. The paid caregivers, as mentioned, were reporting more formal support and instruction on how to assist with oral home care than the families. The families, in contrast, had far more limited forms of instruction, and they seemed to be relying heavily on trial and error. Basically, they were on their own. Both groups found patient-specific instructions at the dental visit to be useful. Now, there are a number of limitations to the survey. It's very likely that the caregiver sample was not representative for a number of reasons. Furthermore, the caregiver self-reports may be biased in favor of optimal, not actual, oral health practices. The reports of the oral health problems reported by the caregivers represent their perceptions and not diagnoses. And then finally, our focus was on the occurrence of oral home care practices and not necessarily on their quality. So if you asked us, well, was the toothbrushing occurring correctly, we don't know that based on this survey. So what are the implications and some future research issues? Clearly, caregivers need additional support to assist with oral home care. The paid caregivers are typically linked with public systems with the potential to increase instruction and support to these groups. On the other hand, families appeared fairly isolated, so special efforts must be made to reach out to the families to help them access instruction and support. Currently, they're largely on their own. Flossing presents a conundrum for the general population and for this population. Our dental colleagues have explained that if we would ask a group like this, how many of you floss every day as recommended, there would be very few hands that went up. And flossing was not occurring in this population of adults with developmental disabilities either. Nonetheless, flossing is a critical preventive strategy for gum disease and actually tooth loss. So coming up with creative thinking around flossing, alternatives to flossing, and other preventive strategies is a critically important issue. And then finally, good oral health for patients with developmental disabilities requires partnerships between the patients, the dentist, and the caregiver. And efforts to improve oral home care supports must occur hand in glove with efforts to secure access to dental services. We're very fortunate in Massachusetts that we do have the level of support through Medicaid for adult dental services for people with developmental disabilities. Dental DD adults who receive quality oral home care, but they're not in receipt of routine access to dental services, are going to be precluded from achieving optimal oral health, and that's something we all need to be concerned about. Thank you.
There has not been anything out there. I'm going to go in reverse order. There hasn't been anything out there specifically focusing on the knowledge that the MPs, you know, might need. But in reality, the knowledge and the skills and whatnot that the MPs use is probably not dramatically different from that of what physicians need. And we know that in medical education, there's not a lot in most programs. You know, there are efforts in order to increase it. I will tell you, it was the second or third slide up there. We have funding from English Foundation. We also have funding from HRSA. And one of the things that we're doing with that grant is to develop teaching materials for MP faculty. There's going to be some information in there about why it's an important thing to do, why do you think they should do it, the size of the group, et cetera, the background information. Our intent is to make that available to MP programs across the country. Now, does that mean that people are going to do it? Probably not. But we're going to give it our best shot in order to try to, get the information out there. We have gone to some of the nurse practitioner meetings, nurse practitioner faculty meetings, in order to get the information out there, and we're going to continue to do that as long as we have some support. Now your other question had to do with whether or not we defined disability and the models of disability. Is that correct? My memory. I've been affected by my cold. I believe that we did. I actually cannot recall with 100% certainty, you know, in terms of what we meant by disability. In terms of the models, we define, I know for sure we defined each of those, and not in great depth, but we did, you know, give a brief summary about what the models meant.
So in terms of in pediatrics, for the postgraduate level, and I know that Adrienne will like this, because we have what's called the LEND program, Leadership and Education in Neurodevelopmental Disabilities. I know she didn't pay me to say this, but the trainees for this LEND program cover a lot of different disciplines, and over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had at least one or two nurse practitioners who participate in this year-long curriculum on developmental disabilities for children. So, it's at least there's something out there once they finish and if they develop some interest. So I applaud you that you're trying to get it in earlier and get them interested in going with it.
We're trying.
There's one here. Okay. Yeah, I have a question for this man. Do you think that disability should be employed as a standalone topic versus integrated throughout the other curricula?
That's a very good question. No, I don't. I don't think it should be. I think there needs to be some introduction to the topic, but then I think it needs to be integrated throughout the program. We are attempting to do that also with our undergraduate students. You know, for example, there's a communication module that the students do, you know, when they come in fresh out of high school, which they need a lot, you know, in terms of communicating with patients. So one of the things that we have done is to develop a module on communicating with people with disabilities, and then we're doing the same thing throughout the curriculum. And I think if it's set aside, you know, then people are going to say, well, I don't intend to work with people with disabilities. Or it's special in a sense that it doesn't apply to everybody. And so I think it needs to be integrated. And I think it also needs to be integrated in textbooks, because we've also done work in that area as well. I think it needs to be throughout.
Thanks. My question is for anyone who would like to tackle it. One of the recommendations is that the National Council on Disability had to report before we do that, there should be specific licensing questions for the licensing for recognized human professions. And that's really what drives the requirement to have some kind of continuing education. I was wondering if you're just, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm wondering if you are seeing any movement toward changes in licensing requirements that would in fact incorporate competency, measuring competency on these issues. And actually, the second question I have for that.
In terms of pediatrics, it's more a matter of certification as opposed to licensing. Because, for example, in Pennsylvania, as long as you're certified and you've not had problems and you're fulfilling your continuing education, the state doesn't really care. It's the certification board, and I don't know, you know, with so much subspecialty certification, I think things have gotten decentralized, and I truthfully don't know how much in general pediatrics, which is where I think it should be, what you're talking about, should be how much is integrated in there, because thank goodness I don't have to recertify in general pediatrics. I can stick with my subspecialty. But I think it's a really good question, and it should be going back to the American Academy from the pediatric standpoint.
Could I respond relative to nursing? Nurses have to take a licensure exam. It's called NCLEX. In a previous study that we did when we were doing the undergraduate curriculum, one of the responses that I always felt was it was a knife going through my heart. One of the respondents said, well, it's not an NCLEX. It's not an NCLEX? We don't teach it. You know, so that means we need to change that. And one of the things we need to do in order to change that is also get the nursing organizations on board. And I've looked at the you know, the, what do you call them, essentials, you know, their competencies, you know, they're supposed to have at the undergraduate level and, you know, for the various nurse practitioner programs. They don't say anything about disability. They say nothing about disability at all. You know, so one of the things that I'm doing is, you know, trying now to go to the major nursing organizations, you know, that affect nursing education. And I actually did slide in a door. I was able to open a door with one of the organizations. And the people in the organization said, this is something that we need to do something about. And I said, yes. So there, you know, it's taken a long time to get there. You know, and I don't know how it is in some of the other disciplines, but that's how it is in nursing. If the awareness is simply not there, it is nothing. Unfortunately.
Can I just ask the second question, which is probably for the book Cure Act has a position that it was intended to pay for education of medical professionals in the disability area, as far as I'm not funded yet. And I'm wondering if you know what the status of that division is, whether you're seeing any money coming down for education in your areas, or if you have any updates.
You know, somebody mentioned that this morning at one of the earlier sessions, and I know Barbara, what's her name, Cornblatt? Did I get that name right? She's going to be speaking, I think, in the next section, the next session, and that might be a very good question to ask her.
She
doesn't know either? And she won't be here. Okay. Got caught up in the weather, probably. I don't know, but according, you know, whoever it was this morning mentioned it is there somewhere, but she didn't, this person this morning did not know where. You know, within the documents.
We know where it is, we just wonder what's going on with the issues.
I don't know.
Okay. Right.
Other question?
I have a question for the
people.
I'm very nice to follow this, and it reminds me that the deaths associated with the past year is done for the IT institution technology. And I was wondering that is your online curriculum can be transferred into the, some kind of educational material available for the uniform staff members or family members to desensitize the users. And before going to the exam, because I know that to bring a patient to the hospital exam, the patient doesn't recover easily, you can just dismiss without doing anything. I think your approach can have a great potential to address that type of issue.
Thank you very much. And actually, that is the main aim with this, is to start off. You know, with something to see if it works, modify it based on the responses, and that's why I said my next step is the need to tap a larger sample to know if, you know, how widely this is accepted, and then to take it to the level where we could have proposed incorporate this as something, you know, as a defense diving program for this woman. Yeah, thank you. Difficult to comment on that because it was an online survey. So they may have been women who, you know, went from the pre-test to the educational intervention and moved on to the post-test. They may have been women who come back later, maybe a day later, and, you know, do the educational intervention and do the post-test, or maybe just come back a day later and do the post-test. So unfortunately, I will not be able to comment on the exact time lapse of how women have taken the survey.
This is a dental question. That's your issue about oral health and flossing. And I think you made a point about the general population doesn't floss that much. But
that's what I've been told.
But across any good patient education material for those people with motor-related disabilities for whom flossing is not all that easy or realistic? I mean, everyone always just says floss. But when you can't floss or when flossing is compromised due to disability, there's never a comeback. And so if you can't floss, do this or that or whatever.
You're absolutely right, and that was why in my concluding comment I raised the need to come up with perhaps some other ways to do it. And within our group, we've talked about there are people who flossing is just impossible. I mean, they don't have the motor skills or other skills. If that's the case, then what are some other preventive strategies to lower the risk for periodontal disease, gingivitis, and tooth loss? Right now, we in our group don't know of other strategies, but there's clearly a need to develop other approaches. I mean, there are some folks working on things like approaching a lot of these issues from the basic, the basis of basic science, bacteria counts, et cetera. I mean, maybe there are risk levels based on that, and maybe there are strategies that would respond to that to eliminate flossing if it's just not going to happen. But to the best of my knowledge, no one has come up with those particular strategies yet. But I think it's an issue. We did another study as part of this larger NIDCR grant that actually looked at the clinical records of over 4,000 adults with developmental disabilities served in the same statewide clinic system, and the prevalence of edentulism was over 10%, and that's very, very unfortunate. And it was happening at earlier ages than it happens in the general population. So the need to develop strategies, preventive strategies, is huge.
Can I follow up on that as well? Paula, the part of the problem is what people eat, you know, like sweets and stuff like that. So I know you can't deprive somebody of everything, but is that part of what is...
Well, actually, we didn't look at that because there are only so many things we can look at, but my colleague, Aviva Musk, might be able to comment on that. Aviva is a nutritional epidemiologist. Clearly, diet is very, very important. And we've done a little bit of work with our dental students to try and get a handle on that. One of the things we learned in our epidemiologic profile was that the adults with DD who were most able, the highest functioning level, the most independent, had the highest prevalence of untreated caries. You know, that's counterintuitive for some people who would think that if someone has a severe level of disability, that their dental disease would be higher. But it was actually the people out and about and perhaps eating what they wanted when they wanted, not making other food choices. But Aviva, do you have anything to add? Or?
No, I mean, I think your hypothesis is probably
good.
So they can get access to candy and
on their own. Right, access to candy and perhaps having caregivers that feel like they're on their own and don't need to be helping encourage them to do the oral hygiene.
In relation to that, in Arkansas, we don't provide oral health care in the community, but they can go to one of the six state-run organization institutions to get health care, mm-hmm. and if they are higher functioning in the community on their own, they will not know. And so that's more of a cultural barrier than it is anything else. Can I get a question for you? I actually, I'm with the Arkansas Disability and Health Program, and I go around the state and teach women how to prepare for mammograms and pap smears. And I was wondering the effectiveness of online-based curriculum versus face-to-face curriculum.
That is a good question, and maybe that's something to think about, and maybe you will provide some study on with an online study versus a more personal kind of study. Also, I feel the level or disability may make a huge difference here, because with my study, we specifically targeted mild to moderate, and the study itself revealed that there's a huge difference going from the mild to the moderate. So I guess depending on the severity, you know, an online versus something with a more personal interaction would be beneficial. Did that answer your question?
Any other questions or speakers?
Hi, Regina, I was wondering, you had a pretty high blank form rate in your pre-post, and I was wondering if you looked to see if they were the more moderately disabled individuals, or whether it was just a lack of wanting to respond to questions that you might have.
True, it was difficult to assess because, like I said, there is no information put in at all. There is no way of identifying those flagged returns that I had. There's just no information put in. So, you know, I probably think that the people who started off, you know, and probably were overwhelmed and not do anything, or maybe revisited and started off a new form altogether. So,
that's
the first comment on what actually led to those 10 black bombs. So I guess I was wondering if you're going to do anything in your future
work to try to figure out who these people are and what
Sure, definitely, and not that you brought up, definitely that's something I'm looking to.
Okay, time for one last question. If you have any questions.
A question on the oral health stuff, and it's kind of beyond the scope of the presentation, but have you found in the group posts that you come across any strategies that have been effective in increasing kind of oral health behaviors and supporting the staff to be able to support those behaviors, or has anything kind of popped out as particularly effective in doing that, or ineffective?
Okay, the group in Montana, has been doing that. I've actually sought some information, and I'm hoping to talk with them here. I don't know what it is they're doing, but they're trying to work with caregivers. Is there anyone here from the Montana group?
I am not, but their program is Health Have Healthy Teens.
Okay, that's the only. That's the only group that I know of that's tried that. I'm very, very interested in. In what it is that they're doing and what they've learned from that. I mean, when you talk with people about the need for that, they'll say, oh, the turnover of caregivers and such, that, you know, training them is going to make a difference. But we found in our group that there actually wasn't that much turnover. So I think it's definitely a direction to go in.
Well, I
want to
thank again the one speaker on the panel. We're at time. I'm sure there are other questions. Let's join me in.